You're listening to The Weekly Show on Discourse.
Wow. I feel illuminated after that debate.
Oh, I don't. It was interesting. I thought Key was notably more aggressive, sometimes possibly occasionally to his detriment. But the big one there was Cunliffe refusing to answer a really important question about the impact of a capital gains tax on people whose houses are in trust.
So this is this election's show me the money moment?
Yeah, I reckon that. He needed an answer there. And Cunliffe did come back. He is so weak on Christchurch.
Right. It was in Christchurch, wasn't it?
Yeah. And that was the major audience. There actually aren't that many of us dicks watching on the internet. Yeah. Key is weak on Christchurch. It's surprising.
All right, well, let's say that
it sounds like it's an annoyance. He doesn't care.
Yeah. Well, kind of everything seems like it's an annoyance to him. Let's say that we've started because, we might as well have.
Right. Are we recording me there?
We record everything. Don't need to put that bit in.
Oh, is that a problem?
Oh, no, that's great. I was hoping you were. Otherwise, I would have had to say it again.
No, and it was so good, so you'd never be able to get it out again.
Skype automatically records. So welcome to Discourse this week. I'm Morgan Avery, and that's Dylan Reeve. I should say, good day, Discourse files.
Yes.
We're joined this week by Russell Brown.
Are you recording, by the way?
Just for a while, till he gets bored.
Yeah, right. And we've all just been watching the, aside from Dylan, who doesn't watch things, we've been watching the Christchurch Press leaders debate with John Key screeching into his microphone.
I started to watch it, and then I got sick of writing the volume control to try and make it not ridiculously annoying for everyone around me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty good example of how difficult it is to produce this kind of thing in a non-studio venue.
Yeah. It's not difficult.
I've seen another example of how difficult it is.
It is difficult. Yeah, it's difficult to do this. The green room thing I did for the Greens last week at Golden Dawn came off pretty well.
Yeah.
But it was very seize of the pants. And it is quite hard. It actually makes me feel quite good about the two seasons we did at Media 3 in a 70s ballroom.
Yeah,
that was pretty good.
We actually did get a program to wear with that. But the stuff like sound is surprisingly difficult in a casual venue as opposed to a studio.
So. Although they were close mic with those little headset mics. It really was a matter of either poor testing or poor operation. Like they should have been able to catch that, you know, even in the first few minutes and sort it out. But
I agree. I've used those headset mics and I've never heard them sound like that. That was pretty poor. And also they made Radio Live grumpy by charging them to use the feed. And Radio Live said, no, we're not going to pay $200 to plug into your system. We'll pull up our own mics. And apparently we're quite glad they did. So.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been, it would have driven you nuts if that was coming through your radio.
Mm. Yeah, and apparently some people were getting feedback. We weren't getting feedback. Anyway, production issues.
It is. I reckon it is difficult. Dylan makes the stuff. He makes it look easy because he actually. So when we did Discourse Votes 2011, we were. It might have. You know, we are half-assed motherfuckers who pretty much fly by the seat of our pants every week doing the podcast, which is in our relatively controlled, you know, home offices. The votes thing was at Cactus Lab in Newmarket. It was great fun, but. So we might seem like dickheads, but there were actually a bunch of actual TV professional people there who were doing things like running the sound and running all the cameras and stuff. And, there is a vast gulf in the skills and talents of people who maybe are hobbyists at best versus people who actually are real pros.
Really? Yeah. I mean,
or I have to say, even between people who shoot commercials or corporate videos or something and people who are used to doing live OBs. Not easy. Dylan's actually great. There was a little piece of logic that Dylan brought in that made Media 3 work. You know, this little board that we plugged everything into. And, you know, there are ways of doing it right, and it's not necessarily easy.
Yeah.
Well, the thing we did most wrong last time, I think, with Discourse Votes was that we did load in about an hour before we wanted to broadcast.
Yeah, that was tough.
And I think that was a bit optimistic.
That's just unprofessional.
Yeah.
Well, we do have standards to maintain.
This time we might try and get in there at least like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours before we start.
Yeah.
Well, I'm actually testing some equipment this time before I use it.
Don't make promises you can't keep.
Might read a manual or two. So, Russ, we asked you to join us because the election's interesting and you're a good commentator on such things.
Can I just, before Russell actually provides some insight, can I just say that it's turned all exciting? Like, I wasn't looking forward to this election because it felt a bit like a foregone conclusion. And maybe it still is, but now it's like fascinating. Every day there's some new disaster. It's bloody wonderful. It's so much fun to watch.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I mean, I think Monday, yesterday, which was only yesterday, it felt like it wasn't safe to move away from the computer in case something else happened or something else got leaked. No, it is fascinating. It's an unprecedented election campaign. And Raymond Miller, who's on Mediatake tonight, 10:30 on Māori Television, agreed with me when I put it to him. I said, is there any precedent for this campaign? And he, Associate Professor of Political Science, said no. We're living through extraordinary times.
Yeah.
It's a pretty astonishing show.
Mediatake would have been on two nights ago when this show's released.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Yeah, so you can pick it up on some sort of on-demand, I'm sure. Is there an on-demand?
Yeah, on Māori, yeah.
Māori Television, yeah.
Not that I haven't. I mean, obviously, I know
that. We made it last night and we had to make it pretending it was tonight, so.
Yeah. We know the feeling. We make this show live on Thursday mornings.
So, the whale dump thing like that, it was good. It's gotten better, and then it took a real turn for the surreal when suddenly John Key was releasing Whale Oil's emails.
Yeah, and there are still two theories on the release of that email. One, which I suspect to be true, is that they thought that something worse was coming up, or they thought that Matt Nippet at the Sunday Star Times had something on the SFO FMA story that implicated Judith Collins, and they thought, shit, let's preempt it. And what actually happened was that Matt heard it about midday, that it was coming. And he thought it was actually going to displace his story, and then they realised that, hang on, actually, this is the story. They've leaked their own email against Judith Collins because they think that we've got this. And so his pretty good story turned into a hell of a story because the career of a minister ended, and I don't think she'll be back.
So, is it possible that Cactus Kate panicked?
Yes, yeah. So that's part of that. Cactus Kate panicked, and if it did fatal damage to the National Party, then she'll have to live with that. It could be that Cactus Kate did the thing that gave Labor the election. I think it's still an outside chance. Of course, the other theory is that they needed a pretext. The National had been looking at their internal polls.
Yeah.
And you only had to look at the published polls. The coal mine Brunton, people had lost patience with Collins. Mm. So National needed a pretext that was not connected to Dirty Politics, Nicky Hager's book, in order to force Collins to stand down. So that's the other theory.
It couldn't have been anything that John Key had already addressed and backed her on.
Yes, exactly, and it couldn't be anything that would validate anything in the book. So they had to come up with something new. That's that theory, yes.
So yeah, that was the one I went for first, and then until I read Nippet's article, and then I thought, oh, maybe not. But it felt like that.
What we did on the program was record an extra 10 minutes with Raymond Miller and Matt. And what Matt says in that extra 10 minutes, which is online only, is really interesting because he talks about being one of those journalists who took tips from Cameron Slater, who was part of that ecosystem. And he expresses regret. And and we've seen David Fisher do the same thing. So that there's quite a bit of soul searching going on with some very good journalists at the moment.
So as a blogger, you, Russell, not us, we have blogs,
it's
but aren't
me.
Bloggers. Do you think that this has changed your relationship with other journalists?
No, because none of the stuff that this is about really applied to us. So I was on First Line this morning with David Slack, who used to be on Public Address, and none of us have ever had briefings from Party Central.
Who's the left-wing attack blogs then? Because there's clearly lots of them. John Keane's referring to them.
Obama thinks he is, but there is no comparison. This actually really bugs me. I think any comparison of what appears to have gone on amongst these people is with anything that's gone before is fatuous. Particularly the SFO and Financial Markets Authority stuff. If it is what it looks like in those emails and in Matt's story, this is people in a paid conspiracy to undermine law enforcement authorities, misuse evidence, and intimidate witnesses. And I really think there will be criminal charges about this, and there's quite a few people, I think, are in denial about it. It's really bad.
Mike Hosking.
Mike Hosking's been ridiculous. It's fun, though. You know,
I've been listening to Mike Hosking's editorials on the Harrogate website every morning, and he seems very reasonable.
Yes.
The first night when none of us had really had it. I mean, I didn't even have my copy for days. But on that first night when none of us had really consumed the book yet, some people had allegedly speed read it.
The one guy on Campbell Live, he was a
He was on Paul Henry. He was on Paul Henry, wasn't he?
Oh, no, sorry, you're right, Paul Henry. My mistake,
Henry,
sorry.
Yeah, that was Charles Finney, who is friends with all the people in the book. It was a ludicrous choice. He's a government lobbyist.
Right, exactly. So Mike Hosking, I don't know, maybe as a New Zealand's most prominent media commentator, Russell, what kind of disclosure should there reasonably be with people like, for instance, Paul Henry, who was a National Party candidate, or Mike Hosking, who I think is pretty tight with John Key personally, should there be disclosure each time they talk about this stuff? Because when Mike Hosking was, I thought, quite clearly running defense for the National Party at 7:01 p.m., immediately after the evening news on New Zealand's biggest news broadcaster, saying there's no story there, he says he's only a commentator or whatever he claims he is, but I feel like his position is so prominent on what is, you know, allegedly a public broadcaster. We can come back to that in a little bit. It's so prominent that I feel like that he actually there's got to be some kind of ethical standard that he and Paul Henry, to a lesser extent, should be being held to, because I mean that was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was, and but if you are one of the many New Zealanders who listen to talk radio, you've been bombarded with the idea that this book is a load of invented crap.
Yeah.
If you listen to Larry Williams or Leighton Smith, or until he turned Sean Plunkett. So Hosking's not alone. I think the interesting thing is someone should ask him and. Who gets to interview, I'm not sure, whether he gets phone calls from Key, because I gather there's a few of those guys actually do have a telephone relationship with Key. And, it's kind of interesting. Yeah,
but everyone knows the mainstream media is horribly left-wing, or is that maybe it's...
Journalists, there are some research say that journalists are, but I don't know whether the publications can be called that.
No, they certainly aren't. The Hosking thing is kind of crazy, but you sort of know what you're getting.
Yes,
but the thing for me is...
He is
like,
what he is. And exactly.
Putin is more interesting to me at the moment.
Oh, Putin's fascinating. I actually still quite like Matthew Hooton. He's on the fringes of this thing, and he's been very entertaining. He picked a weird time to give up drinking, and I'm not actually joking. he's been open about it. He gave up drinking 10, 12 days ago. Right. So he's been into the midst of all this. And it's hard to tell what his game is. He of all of them, I think, is the one that I would still enjoy the company of. You know, he's kind of an outcast of the inner circle as well. You know, I don't think that that the Prime Minister's office likes Houghton.
Oh no, clearly not. If this talk of what's Houghton's company?
Exceltium.
Exceltium. Excelsior. If this talk of the Prime Minister's office screaming at like Sarah for employing Exceltium to do, I don't know, it's like some sort of international research about who was going to invest, and then screaming at them and saying that it wasn't appropriate for them to get involved, and then Brownlee saying, basically, shut the fuck up, Prime Minister's office. You're not actually allowed to even comment on this. You are currently breaking the law. It seems like that was the spark that set him off.
Yeah, that was quite weird. And they did not like the fact that he ran the pretty successful campaign on about Chorus, the axe the tax thing.
Right.
So yeah. The thing with, I mean, if my recollection is correct, the first few days of the Dirty Politics book release, Houghton was kind of rubbishing it, you know, as Hosking and others still are. But he's clearly turned with the revelation of more whale dump stuff. And he's reacting a bit like, this is what frustrates me, right, is if I were a supporter of a thing, be it a political party or a company or whatever, and that thing did something that I thought was grossly, or appeared to have done something that I thought was grossly against the ethics or the you know, the intended practices of that thing, then I wouldn't contort myself to defend the thing. I would, you know, I would be among the most highly critical. Like, I don't, it's crazy to me, all these, until recently, people I'd thought were, you know, quite reasonable in their political perspectives, at least, you know, were honest about why they believed one thing or another, contorting themselves all over the place to be defensive of what seems to be blatantly wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly the case with what was in Matt Nippert's story. This is the actual integrity of our financial markets at stake here. And if you have this kind of defamation for hire operation going, and it does actually have an influence, that's actually a really bad look for New Zealand. And I've been astonished, actually, at some of the right-wing people who, yeah, look, forget any of the political dimensions, forget Judith Collins. When you look at what seems to have been happening here, it's incredibly toxic and it's actually bad for the New Zealand markets. But you can't tell these guys.
And if I were aligned with National and a National Party member, I would be horrified about that. Like, I would not want that to be happening in my name, you know? I'd be calling that out, I think.
Yeah, you would hope that there are, there is...
I'm sure there are people who are doing it.
You would hope that there's stuff happening internally and national, because the Simon Lusk chapter in the book is pretty alarming as well. It does give the impression that there are MPs in the New Zealand Parliament who are there because they paid Lusk and Slater to destroy their opponents. Yeah. That's what the book says. Wow.
Yeah, and I think you only get into a position of being, you know, shortlisted to campaign for an electorate if you are already an insider, right?
Yeah.
And so that person, or the people who would have, it was up north, was it East Coast Bays? No, it wasn't East Coast Bays. One of those up north little ones, I think a pretty safe national electorate. They just totally fucked the guy over and he's raging. Yes. Totally. Yeah.
No, there was Ben Robinson and Mark Mitchell and Rodney, yes.
Right, Rodney, yeah.
Yeah.
Rodney.
Which is the, Rodney is what you pass through when you go to Mirawai.
Yeah.
Basically, yes.
Yeah.
The degree of denial is really quite remarkable, because there is actually plenty of evidence. There's certainly enough evidence for it to be very, very concerned.
So what about the new Judith Collins Cam Slater stuff that was in the paper? I say today, but I really mean 2 days ago when you're listening to this.
The big misconception about that is that it is entirely new. That conversation's quoted in the book on page 46.
Right.
And the only thing that's new is the claim that it's forged. So make it that what you will.
Well, if it is forged, it's done quite amazingly. Like, the thing that was most astonishing to me in reading the other articles about it was that it mentions a conversation that Cam mentions a conversation he had with Greg O'Connor, and Greg O'Connor confirms that that conversation took place.
Yes.
So
yes.
If someone has forged it, they have done a very good job.
Yeah.
And
I mean, other parts have been released, make it pretty clear it's Collins.
He tweeted earlier on that Slater and Collins think they've gotten away with it because they deleted the account she was using. But he has since sent stuff to Patrick Gower at 3 News, which appears to confirm that these are, in fact, genuine emails. It's other other Facebook messages between them.
Yeah, that seemed very clearly related to them.
Yeah, it does. And as Toby Manhai pointed out earlier this evening, Whale Dump's not stupid. He is now working with David Fisher, Matt Nippet, and Patrick Gower, all three of whom would probably otherwise have been trying to find out who he was. he's their source and they can't reveal it.
So you remember the day after Duty Politics came out, or maybe a couple of days after, Cam Slater said on his blog that he knew who the hacker was and he was going to reveal, we knew who did this and we'll reveal your names unless you own up and tell us who, you know, and acknowledge who paid you. We know who paid you. We know it was Kim.com, but own up. And
I was approached by a prominent New Zealand journalist asking me if I was Rorschach.
Really?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, really.
Awesome.
Yeah. Wow, people overestimate your technical abilities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Could not possibly be any further from the truth. I mean, I would have none of the skills required to do that, but...
I'm disappointed no one asked me now, because I've used the internet for a long time.
Yeah.
Oh.
I can do Google site search.
Yeah, well, that would have got you the Labour Party donors list, but it wouldn't have got you much further than that.
That is true. The most likely scenario is that Rorschach is one of the wider group around Judd Hall, guy that Slater mocked, you know, called Feral. And
yeah, because I didn't realise that he hung in those circles. He was a hacker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And I had no idea of that. And of course.
But by far seems more credible. It makes the whole
because everyone was like at the time when the DDoS was happening, they were like, oh, how can a bunch of West Coast, you know, people manage a DDoS? It's like, well, actually, it turns out really, really easily now.
Yeah, exactly.
No question.
Yeah, they knew some people who could. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone who Hager has, you know, expressed his admiration for Rorschach and said he has. Identified Rorschach as male and basically depicted him as sophisticated and principled.
That's clearly not me. I don't know why anyone would ever have got that idea.
Exactly. Probably not any of us. But apart from the early dalliance with memes, which I thought was a bit shit, yeah. Rorschach actually has conducted himself reasonably well, you know, on that Whale Dump account. So...
I've made a couple of requests on Twitter to him because it's the only way I know how to get hold of him to come and talk to us on the show, but it would be terrible operational security for him. But still, I'd like him to do it.
If someone voices words or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure he's got access to some sort of voice distorter thingy. It'd be great fun. Because there's so many questions.
It was interesting talking to Matt. He had to kind of upskill pretty quickly and... Yeah, the modern journalistic skill of encrypted communications.
Yeah, that was a big thing with the Snowden stuff as well. There was a whole lot of backstory stuff about how, you know, what's his name, Greenwald had to get all encryptable before Snowden would send him stuff.
And Key Thing actually wrote a couple of blog posts a wee while ago about, you know...
That's right.
Encryption for, it was really difficult.
Well, it is, and the
I'm too old. I'm too old to do this.
Well, the bigger issue is
a little easier.
There's many, many ways you can fuck it up. Kim.com was supposed to be. I don't know what's happened to it. He was supposed to be setting up some sort of encrypted messaging service.
Via Mega, yes.
I'm sure he'd do that correctly, so that, you know, his employed hackers could send him information.
Yes. Exactly.
I saw John Key in his press statements about it today had turned around to referring journalists that they should ask the criminals involved, things like that, and also made mention of, you know, ask him, you know, what was stolen and who paid for it, which I thought was an interesting, like, oh right, now we're making it that again. So, you know, that's straight out of Cam Slater's talking points, really.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. this is going to, I think, my guess is that National will win but be tainted. Although Winston Peters' bottom line today was interesting because he wants a Royal Commission and he will be fussy about terms. The National won't get away with what they've announced so far.
So jumping ahead about 2 weeks, on September the 15th, Kim.com is promising something. You got any suspicions or expectations?
My only guess is that it shows Key knows what he's been claiming he hasn't known.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what he's been hinting, that he would release that information close to the election for, it feels like a year now.
Yeah.
So,
And it may have actually come out in the course of his extradition case, but that keeps getting put back.
Right.
So, it has to come out at this event. It's funny because everyone thought, oh my God, that's way too close to, everything will be done and dusted by then.
You won't have a chance to make a shake. But now it could just be enough to be a final hit or two.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think of his decision to include Assange?
I think that's a tactical error, which will probably not be entirely popular within the party. There are, within Internet Mana, there are some tensions between Mana and the Internet Party. The way that the jobs policy was announced at the campaign launch was not, I think Honi Haruira was a little annoyed about that, but on the other hand, I don't think it's quite where Georgina Beyer has been depicting it. Have you guys seen that? She's been a member of the Mana Party for a month, isn't on the party list, is representing Te Tau Tonga in the South Island, and has totally gone feral and declared that the .com has his fingers in everything in the party and, is undermining Mana's leaders, who are actually not very happy about her going on and saying this. So.
Well, to be honest, though, I'm a little surprised you don't hear more of that from the Mana faithful, because it's not an unfair statement in some ways, and all other things being equal, you'd expect that if the Internet Party weren't aligned with Mana, Mana seems to be the sort of party who'd make a stink about what's going on.
Yes, possibly, but on the other hand, because the launch last weekend was around the corner from my house, a couple of us popped around, and the Mana faithful do like .com. He's actually presented pretty well at these roadshows. Apparently he did quite well up in Te Tau Tokoro up north and charmed the aunties. So it's odd because the public image of Internet Party events has been fuck John Key charts.
Yeah.
Whereas they've done far more where they've had full community halls of nanas who've rather liked him.
Well, he's a for whatever his failings may be, and Morgan frequently diatribes in that direction.
Yeah.
But he is a fairly charismatic guy, and he clearly usually knows how to play an audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, he has done quite well at these things. I think some of the policy is kind of vague and fanciful.
Well, it's easy to be vague and fanciful when you're a very minor party.
Exactly.
You can promise the world because you're not going to have to deliver it.
Exactly. Yeah. I think realistically, you have one thing that you would like to achieve, and you strike a series of positions.
See, I was always hoping the Internet Party would be that. I wanted them to be apolitical in a left right sense, and just be a political party version of Internet NZ, promoting entirely things related to the internet, ICT, that sort of stuff. But sadly, that's not where it went.
No, it wasn't. I guess people would argue with you whether it was truly possible to be apolitical.
Well, you could just not have you can not have policy on social matters.
Yeah, not quite. It's interesting. I'm as dubious as I am about some of the policy. I think some of the people they brought through as candidates are really interesting. Chris Yong used to be the guitarist in Tadpole. is the highest ranked candidate outside the old people at the top of the list. And he's actually a really good guy. And Miriam Pera, it's kind of interesting. And Pani Farbid, who's an Iranian feminist academic who can talk about porn. They're actually kind of interesting people who wouldn't have come through in a Labour Party selection process. But whether it's got legs after the election, who knows? Not everything about the internet party is bad, I think.
Do you think they'll deliver a higher poll result? A higher election result than their polling? Because I find it very hard to believe that they won't. I know what all the statistics say about the relative accuracy and things of polls, but I can't help but think they're going to turn out quite a lot more than people think.
I think they'll be better at it than the Greens, who always looked like they were going to deliver, and I think well this time. But how many times have the Greens kind of under-delivered the elections? They've got at the campaign launch, they said they were going to launch this campaign app called Mobility or something. I can't remember what it was called.
Mobilize.
Mobilize, that's it. And I don't know, has that come out? Because they
It must have, because Cam Slater was attacking it the other day.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that's how you'd know. So maybe there is a degree of that campaign that's happening off the usual radar. And maybe there will be, some more votes. But I wouldn't take it as red, put it that way. But I'm sort of fonder of the internet party than a lot of people are. I think the people they brought through are kind of interesting.
I feel like it's still a really weird combination.
It's a very weird combination.
Well, but they've made it very clear what's going to happen afterwards. This is for the election.
Yeah, but it'll still be Laila Hari will be the leader of the Internet Party, and she didn't know who her ISP was. She shouldn't be the leader of something called the Internet Party.
I wonder if she knows now.
I'm sure she knows now, but the point isn't what you can swat up on. I feel like to be in a position like that, you should actually be into. I mean, you shouldn't just be like a political SWAT. Obviously, she's got a long history as a politician. She has done the hard yards, but not for a party like that. Like, she's just sort of a general lefty, Not a tech
lefty.
Yeah, not a tech. Well, I don't even know if Internet Party needs to be left or right, because I feel like the issues should be quite specific, access stuff, privacy stuff, free speech stuff. That is really what I think of as, the wheelhouse of an Internet Party.
She's a left-wing technocrat. You look at her last big job was the HR job and the formation of the Auckland Council. Right. So she's had a series of these, quite high-level procedural sort of corporate jobs.
Well, there is that thing. A lot of.
And she's not Sue Bradford, put it that way.
She's not. A lot of very good IT policy, IT project managers are not super technical. There is some advantage, allegedly, in having non-technical people leading technical people.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's a different mindset kind of thing. So maybe there's some sense of that. I don't know. But. Yeah, I think the election's going to be interesting. It's going to make our discourse votes show much more fun.
Indeed. Hey, I'm actually going to go and top up my glass of wine now and watch Media Take.
I highly recommend it. I hear it's quite a good show.
Of the past. If you haven't watched it, listeners, go to the website, Māori Television website, find us and watch especially the online-only extra where Matt Lippert really kind of unburdens about stuff, and it's good.
All right, very quick question before we release you. Did you go to the broadcasting little hooey thing the other day?
I was tired. I've been away all weekend.
I haven't heard much about what went down. I saw a few tweets. So
I do find it encouraging that there are these sector-specific debates. There's actually been quite a lot of policy debate in this campaign, I reckon.
But
maybe it hasn't reached everyone, but...
As John Key keeps lamenting, we're not hearing about policy, although that's partly because he's not talking about it.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have a lot. Okay.
All right, see you later.
Bye. I'm pretty sure that was the old sign off or something like that. Goodbye. I can't do it though.
Goodbye. So. That's it. Yeah, right.
There we go. Perfect.
Bye.
See, our listeners won't have heard that for a very long time. That's of course from the old Hard News show.
Didn't that exist still even after it stopped on BFM in some sense for a long time?
There was an email list.
Maybe you just wrote it. Okay. Anyway.
And then I guess that turned into public address.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. It was great. Hard News was absolutely fantastic. It was a really accessible way to follow politics and interesting ideas. He's a really good writer, Russell.
Yeah. Just like Discourses Now.
Yeah, well, exactly like Discourses Now, only didn't do the, you know, the crazy bits that when I just go off on a complete wild.
Well, and the unstructured rambling. It was less of the unstructured rambling. Yeah,
exactly. So that was actually all very – I had like – I wouldn't say that I had a plan, but I did have sort of a rough outline of how I thought the beginning of the show was going to go. And then, of course, the leaders' debate meant that we pretty much – started the call exactly when the show started, and so none of it really happened. So for instance, I was going to talk about how, you know, previous couple of weeks we've had two guests on. Today I was thinking about inviting ACT Epsom candidate David Seymour on, but you know, it's easy to think if it's not actually about to happen, it's easy to imagine the things you're going to say to someone. Like, for instance, I imagined that I would start by saying something like, are you as much of a dickhead as you come across? But you can't actually say that to someone who, I mean, he's never done anything to me.
Yeah, and see, if you did that, you would come across as quite a dickhead. And
exactly. And
while people may disagree, I don't think you are.
I'm very grateful for you saying that. So then at that point I was like, okay, well, so actually I need to do some research, figure out what the policies are, figure out what I disagree with them on. And so I went to the ACT website and I started going through their policies and I just couldn't really stand it. And so then I decided that we just couldn't talk to them. But so maybe I'll touch base and we can talk on election night when the results start rolling in, because it'll actually be really interesting that, you know, obviously Epsom is going to be a big deal, the results of Epsom, and he's probably going to win Epsom.
Well, so of course the last time it wasn't close at all.
It was close.
No, it wasn't close between National and ACT.
Oh yeah. That's correct.
Like, and I didn't think it was anywhere else.
So did you know that ACT only got just a hair over 23,000 party votes at the last election? 23,000 party votes. That's extraordinary. Labour had something like 600,000 party votes, right? Just to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
I probably shouldn't say that just off the top of my head. It may have been 400,000 for all I can remember, but it was just like absolutely a vast difference. Like,
okay, Labour had 614,000 right. And ACT had 23,889.
Party votes? I thought it was 23,389.
No, 23,889. So right. Just under 24,000. Call that 24. They got 1.07% of the party vote.
Right.
Labour got 27.5%.
And the Conservatives got like 58,000 something, high 50,000.
Conservatives more than doubled ACT.
Well over doubled, right? They were almost 60,000, right?
They almost made 3%. They were 2.65%.
And they were unrepresented 60,000. In Parliament. Now, that is, of course, because of the MMP threshold. And some of us, I don't know if you agree, some of us think that the threshold should be much lower, because I think that if Conservatives manage to get...
Where would the threshold be?
I think it should be about 2%.
Because if you look at
the last... I think it should be about 1 or 2%. I think 5% is too high. And the only other realistic proposal I've ever seen for lowering it was only to 4%.
Well, and if you look at the last election, I suppose if the percentage were lower, maybe it would change the dynamic of the election. But if you look at the last election, if it would lower to 2%, it would only make, it would make other changes, but it would only make one significant change, and that would be Conservatives would get a seat, because no one else broke 2%.
Sure, but I feel like they probably deserved to get in.
They may have. Because
that's not an insignificant number of
people. It's a lot easier to ignore Colin Craig when he's not in Parliament, though.
Like, that's a whole city. You know, one of the small cities.
Yeah, 60,000 people. Yeah, totally.
Like, that's a small city with the people who said, we want these guys representing us. Or maybe the percentage should float and it should be like the equivalent of, as long as you get over the what it would take to get an electoral candidate in. As long as you get over that, you get a list candidate, unless you also got an electorate candidate. I don't really like the coat-telling stuff. What?
What do you mean what it would take to get an electorate candidate in?
So the electorates are meant to be divided up roughly by population.
But the problem is the turnout in the individual electorates varies dramatically.
That's right. So it might have to be something like the mean or something.
Yeah. It would certainly...
Sounds untidy. This isn't necessarily a well-conceived and fully formed thought. It's just I feel like 5% is not actually right. We have a proportional system. Just because a party is not super popular doesn't mean that there aren't actually tens of thousands of people who have cast their vote for it. And I feel like if ACT can get in with how many have they currently got? One. They've got one member, right? Because their party vote was so low, well under 1%, right?
No, it was just 1%. It was 1.07%.
Did they actually make it to a whole 1%?
1.07%. Mana got 1.08%. Mana got like another 300 votes.
Right.
More than me.
Yeah. So some people would say that Mana were quite a fringe party. They were on the fringe of the far left. And I think similar people would probably say that ACT were a fringe party. And if they're even a party, they're kind of like a weird little tactical skirmishing group for National, aren't they?
Well, yeah, maybe.
Jamie White might not agree, but...
Oh, I think he probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
So anyway, Discourse votes.
Discourse votes.
We'll be streaming our ridiculousness live for probably about 4 hours.
We're going to try to not be ridiculous. We're going to try to be really good. The best that I hope for is that you give us a chance as your second screen. You put us on your laptop or on your iPad. We're going to be streaming through YouTube, so we'll work on all of your devices.
It will just work.
It will absolutely just work. And if we're using quite different hardware this time, right, Dylan?
Moderately different hardware.
So, you know, I feel like aside from the first 30 minutes or so when the bitrate was wrong, I feel like the quality was really good. You know, it felt like a professional production, you know, right at the end, the last 5 minutes, totally, aside from the icing on the head, you know, it was totally professional in terms of, you know, the quality of
I'm not the sure sound, there was anything the wrong picture. With the icing on the head.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably true. So, I mean, what I mean is, like, once we got the graphics going, everything
and
was running.
And the graphics are good at this time.
Once I told the guy to stop moving that main camera because that was making the stream guys very unhappy.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we'll put the jib in again this time.
Yeah.
Although I'm thinking we might because I have some ideas about the layout. So we'll
I think
see
we've got a lot more room, eh, this time.
We have a lot more room. It looks like we might be able to set up basically two broadcast areas and switch between them.
Oh, brilliant.
So
that'd
like
be great.
There's like a standing bar and a couch area.
Because I don't know if you remember this, but last time I went without a break like the entire night.
I'm also currently looking at the idea of having, we may be able to have a Wellington studio as well.
That'd be cool.
But
who would be in Wellington?
Well, I'll discuss that with you later. We've got some options.
All right. So all of these other little things that we're talking about right now, we shouldn't be talking in front of the listeners because there's a chance it won't happen. But
we want them interested so that, you know.
Oh, no, I don't mean we shouldn't talk about the whole general thing. But specific things.
I'm excited about things that could possibly happen.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Get in touch.
Maybe.
Tell us if you want to what do you want to see on the night? Because, you know, we actually do manage to get access to a surprising number of people. Who would you like us to talk to?
What I would really like would be to be able to have a roving camera crew driving around Auckland and dropping in on viewers.
That's absolutely mad.
It is mad.
Oh!
There is a medium chance to make it happen.
I need to finally figure out if one of our sponsors... is on board or not. We could have like instant giveaways.
Yeah, possibly.
Could just drive them around, but it would have to be people who are fairly central in Auckland.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Because it couldn't be like a 3-hour drive to...
No, we're talking like Greyland, Parnell, you know, Newton, the central suburbs.
Grafton, yeah.
Grafton, Eden Terrace maybe. Dropping on the...
Maybe Kingsland, but not all the way over at like Don Crute.
I mean, we could get, you know, if we get the mobile camera crew thing happening, we could get them to do a run out to Wendy's for us.
I would really. We may
have a food sponsor lined up. So
food sponsor only.
Food sponsor only.
It was hard having a cupcakes as the sponsorship, Delish cupcakes as the sponsor for our house map, because we couldn't really eat them.
No, you have to wait until the house is all locked off before you can start eating the seats. But this time we should have at least one other food option.
It would be absolutely amazing if National didn't manage to put together a government after this election, because I feel like National lose once Key stands down. Like the next election after he stands down, that is when I figured they would probably lose.
It's interesting because
he had stood down this term, it would probably be Collins. Imagine what would be currently happening.
Well, I don't know if hashtag Team Collins works as well.
Yeah. No, well, it certainly doesn't, because she's, you know, the depth of her character has now been revealed. But she was one of the two front runners to take over leadership, right? It was her and Joyce. They were the only names.
And Joyce didn't tweet enough.
So absolutely. She tweeted too much, of course. She had to take a break at one point.
Or no, she quit, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Then she stopped quitting.
Yep. So other things that we could... you didn't listen to last week's show. So you haven't heard about my two new campaigns. Firstly, the campaign to save the V8.
The motoring V8?
Yep. Big engines that use a lot of petrol. It's a campaign to save the VA. And the form that this campaign takes is encouraging development of alternate energy sources so that it's not crazy to operate a V8.
Fantastic. Do you have a V8?
Save the V8. No.
You have a four-cylinder?
I don't own a car. Selena owns two cars. And
oh, my God.
And that's none. Yeah, I own no cars. And my last car, of course, was a Mazda MX-5, which is about as far away from a V8 as you can get.
It has about 1.5 cylinders, I think.
No, it has 4 perfectly good cylinders, has a perfectly lovely engine, and is an extraordinarily nice car to drive, perfectly balanced, and under 1,000 kilo car with a rear wheel drive, and just such a laugh. It's a shame that they have, the weird reputation they've got.
I have a V6 Holden, which is, you know, it's the next best thing.
I do like driving big engines. Big engines are fun. And my other campaign is it's just called LMDJ. Let's make Denmark jealous.
We've got a long way to go.
Yeah, well, that's the point. It's a high target. We're aiming for the moon, we'll at least get wet in the clouds.
You could really shoot for just about any Scandinavian country.
Pretty much. Let's make Norway dangerous with our massive oil reserves.
They're all quite good at running countries.
It's funny how there's this debate.
Very socialist.
Amongst some parties, amongst some people, sectors of society, about whether we should be, risking drilling all of our massive oil reserves. But all of the test holes that have been sunk in the last few years have come up completely dry. It might be a little bit academic. As it turns out, we might not actually have it. There might not be a lot of oil out there. We might just be stuck with those huge deposits of fucking lignite. The worst of all coals.
it's a pretty shit coal.
So I also thought actually it would be really fun to get Hooten on. Maybe we'll try next week. I don't know.
See,
I want to find out.
We don't discuss votes because I'm assuming that all the really good political commentators have already been snapped up by, you know, proper broadcasts.
Oh yeah, no. On it's really hard getting the proper guys on for the votes show. I've already touched base with one or two, and they're doing radio stuff and they're doing TV stuff, and it's just like, you know, we could maybe speak to them during a break, but it's better if we just do that job ourselves. We be the commentators and we talk to the actual politicians who actually will, you know, they'll be off at parties just like last time, but we'll be able to get them. I'm absolutely confident of that. But it would be interesting to talk to Hooten. I'm not sure if I bother, honestly. It would be interesting to talk, though, about what are the schisms in National? What are the major groups?
So it's interesting because, of course, one of the problems that Labour's had is that those schisms are become public. Mm-hmm. That they're not kept under wraps.
That's right.
And so, you know, we assume the same thing doesn't happen within National, but maybe it does. Maybe the same thing is going on there and we just don't know.
I think without a doubt the same thing's going on there. I just don't believe that you get a party that big that many members, that is an entire monoculture. I think they just have they've done a really great job of managing it, managing, you know, internally, the you know, getting people to buy in and stay on message. And on the left, you know, that just, I guess it just didn't really exist. And so instead of having a big party on the left, it all just kind of broke up into lots of little parties. So I'm absolutely sure that there's a similar diversity of belief in National. I mean, of course, I mean, I could actually imagine voting National, not tactically, not strategically, which of course I'm going to do this election, but sincerely, I could imagine doing it, just not this National.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, inherently, like I'm a lot more capitalist than some left wing people, and one of the things that annoys me most is ridiculous left-wing ideologues. But yeah, National, it's not even that the policy is a problem. It's just it's the attitude that's the bigger issue for me.
Yeah.
Like the political attitude of the National Party I don't like.
Yeah. There's a lot of weird, it's just a lot of weird lying. Oh, I don't know. The lying isn't the word that people probably use, but.
Has anyone spoken to Jason Eade? Like,
I don't think he'd speak. No,
he's vanished, though, hasn't he? No one's touched by. No one's found him or spoken to him or seen him.
He's a backroom guy. Do you think he went in someone's trunk and then up north he's buried in a forestry plot?
No, I wouldn't be surprised if he was holidaying in John Key's Hawaiian home, though.
Probably a Canadian-owned forestry plot because, you know, they have actually been on a massive buy-up.
Have they?
Of our forestry land. Yep, absolutely massive. Absolutely massive.
Good for them. They know about trees.
Okay, but here's the thing. They export raw wood. They grow wood and then they export raw wood. And there is very little value in that for New Zealand.
Well, no, I mean, we get to see the trees before they cut down, so that's nice.
Oh, not that much. Not really.
Sometimes you know.
So something I'm very tired of hearing about is child poverty and hungry children in schools. And I don't really want to hear about it or talk about it anymore. I think we just need to have it to be the universal standard in New Zealand primary schools that meals are provided to all children, not just poor children, not just in decile one, but absolutely every school in New Zealand should provide a morning tea and a lunch. It shouldn't be normal, except maybe for kids with really specific dietary requirements, for kids to even take lunch. Maybe a snack, but not a lunch.
So that happens in a lot of American schools.
I think that they actually have to pay for that, though, I think. I don't know that it's necessarily publicly funded.
Yeah.
It's also an English thing where it might be publicly funded, I think. Right. Where you have, you know, the school dinners. Jamie's School Dinners, the TV show, existed because there were all these dinner ladies in schools cooking bad food for a very measly budget, and he went in and showed them how they could make nourishing, higher quality food for a similar price.
And a lot of them did keep doing some of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, New Zealand is, I mean, we are absolutely blessed. We have wonderfully productive farmland. We can make lunches and morning teas for our children.
Sorry, I'm just going to offer this to you now. The National School Lunch Program, which is in the United States, is run by the United States Food and Nutrition Service of the United States Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
And it currently operates in over 101,000 public and non-profit private schools.
Wow.
And it provides nutritionally balanced, low-cost or free lunches to children across the nation.
Right.
In 2011, it fed more than 31 million children each day.
Right. So we need to do that. Like, if America can do it, look how crazy they are about so many things, about healthcare and so on, right? If they have decided to pull their fingers out and just feed the children,
they decided that in 1946, and they haven't got rid of it. It's one of those things that once it's established, you know, like a welfare system, once it's established, it's hard to get rid of.
False.
Well, the problem is establishing. Like, you know, no political party in New Zealand is going to get rid of our basic healthcare system.
Well.
They make all sorts of, they can fuck with it, but, you know, no one's going to actually remove it. No one's going to say you'd be better off paying for your healthcare.
Act would love to get rid of it.
No, they would like to, but they couldn't.
Yeah.
Like, no one's, you know, the public's not going to go for that. Yeah. So same thing with this. Once you've established a thing like that, it's hard to get rid of it.
Yeah. That's right. So I see people talking about someone come up with a plan. Well, other countries have already done it.
Feed children food.
Yeah, just feed children food. Children come school. School make food.
Food. There are of course practical considerations, like for example, schools in the US and the UK where this is a thing, are built with
kitchens and so on.
Dining halls and kitchens, which ours aren't. But that doesn't mean that there aren't ways. You know, people have certainly said that it's possible, and I think Campbell Live has demonstrated that it's possible to have local business, you know, small local businesses contract these services.
Yeah.
Provide them, deliver them.
We've like got 5.8 or 6% or something unemployed people. We could give some of those people a bloody job in a kitchen.
Yeah, well, that's good. A make work program. Excellent.
Well, I mean, we need them. Make work program. Oh, do you know what make work programs do? What make work programs do is make some work. And there are people who need work.
It'd be good if that was, as long as it's, you know.
We could pay them $18 an hour, and that could set the standard for other kitchens around the place. They'd have to lift their game, even if the minimum wage wasn't increased, because they'd be competing on the market for the same staff who wanted to.
Now, obviously, we can't make work with trucking or sheep shearing, because New Zealanders don't want to get up and do that.
Lots of New Zealanders do sheep shearing and trucking.
No, they don't want to. That's why businesses are having to hire overseas immigrants, because New Zealanders don't want to get out of bed.
What? Oh, this is a bloody Jamie White.
That's Jamie White.
Oh God, he's such an idiot.
He's so happy to take any anecdote and make it representative of the nation.
I come from a farming family, and I know what shearing groups what they're composed of. In my experience,
that was before smartphones. Now they just want to stay in bed and read Twitter.
What a load of bloody bullshit! Guy is such a.
Well, there you go. So we suggest we don't get him on the show.
Yeah. So there were two other things I probably should have, that I would have liked to have spoken with Russell about. One is, was it the Greens that proposed a new public broadcaster in New Zealand?
No,
was it Labour? And you strongly disagree, and you reckon that TVNZ are that, and you reckon Māori are that, and so there's already two public TV broadcasters.
Well, the point is we already own two broadcasters. So establishing... I'm not sure because that was one of the things that was kind of where I was heading right at the end, because that was one of the things that came up at that broadcasting debate a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
I don't know the specifics. I haven't gone looking for the policy. I was going to, and I haven't, and I'm not sure if it is specified as policy on Labour's website. But we own already a good portion of facility. TVNZ owns Freeview channels that they're not using, I understand, unless they've leased them out or sold them.
Are you talking about the Plus Ones?
The Plus Ones, I think they still have another one that's not been used, but they may have lent that out to a shopping channel by now. Who knows?
Oh, Christ, those are the most disgusting
things. I can't believe there are three of them. I thought the first one would fail, and now there's apparently three.
Those are such an indictment on our culture of failure.
How do they work?
I'm baffled by it. I don't believe it. I guess they work by being incredibly inexpensive to operate and having volume.
So we had TVNZ 7, right? And it worked. It was actually pretty good.
It was all right. I would actually say that, I mean, I was, when it went away, I was more worried about the potential that was being lost, because the market appeared to be, the viewership appeared to be on the up.
Yeah.
And a big problem, though, was, of course, that TVNZ didn't appear to actually be promoting it.
So that was part of it. So anyway, basically, TVNZ 7 was going to cost...
They had some great shows. Really good shows.
They needed like $16 million or something to continue it for another 5 years. I don't even...
Wasn't that a per-year budget?
Or was it? I don't know. They needed about $16 million to continue it. TVNZ just returned a profit of $18 million.
Right.
From running their... primary broadcast channels.
Right.
And bear in mind, that's on turnover of, goodness, what is it? It's huge. It's like 360 million or something.
Yeah.
I mean, they make 5% profit. That's, anyway.
It's not super good.
So the point is, TVNZ's current only mission, the only responsibility they have to their shareholder, which is
return a dividend.
Is to return a dividend.
Yeah. How about a cultural dividend?
Yeah, so if I were doing it, I'd say, look, let TV1 and TV2 continue as they are. People are happy enough with the content that's on them. But you don't need to return a profit anymore. Any profit you make goes into a public fund, you know, a public broadcasting fund. and that fund is used to operate another channel that is not a for-profit channel, that is essentially the model that TVNZ7 was. You know, and that, basically.
I'm not sure that's quite what we actually should do.
Or alternatively, Māori TV, you know, is changed to TV Aotearoa or something.
No!
I don't know, and another channel is added. No, another channel is added.
You need to think through that a little bit more.
But what I don't think we need is another... I don't think we need to recreate the infrastructure and the you know, all of the nitty-gritty of a broadcaster when we have two. We can certainly change the operating terms of at least one of them.
You're very optimistic about TVNZ. I don't believe they're up to the job, and I don't believe they're interested in doing the job. If they wanted to be a public broadcaster... And my definition of that, and I think you probably are pretty clear with what my definition is. I think if they wanted to do that, they would already do that.
I don't think they can.
They have no interest in doing it.
I don't think they can. I don't think what TVNZ wants. I think TVNZ wants to do whatever they are told to do, basically. You know, the charter, for whatever its ills, it did a reasonable job of delivering, yeah. Of delivering New Zealand content. You know, of delivering a certain type of New Zealand content to us. It could have been.
So. It would seem redundant to create an entirely new broadcast, and that's why some of the suggestions were that Radio New Zealand could take over. I don't believe Radio New Zealand have any interest in running a TV channel. They're a radio station, not a TV producer.
You say that, but they posted a video online today of Ashburton from the air, from a drone.
They're pretty good at running a website too, it has to be said.
So, you know, clearly they're making video content.
Yes, but there's okay. So,
so maybe they
all we need is a YouTube channel, and that's New Zealand's public broadcasting taken care of. Then
maybe
you could do it for a hell of a lot less than $15 million. I bet, but I feel like it would be great if TVNZ could somehow be leveraged to produce it. If some of their facilities, if some of their skills, because there's some amazing people at TVNZ.
And that's essentially, like, they're all, like, almost everything within TVNZ, as it stands at the moment, is available for hire and purchase to outside productions, right? So you can, you know, if you wanted to run a TV station and TVNZ could put a deal together, you know, you wanted to run a TV channel, TVNZ will definitely give you a quote and pitch you on their ability to run it for you. Basically,
it might cost a hell of a lot more to do it that way than to just go the high-tech, modern production route, though.
No, but I'm saying, you know, like, running, you supply the programming and they run it off their servers and they have all the connections to the broadcast, you know, to the broadcast infrastructure, and they do all that stuff. They deliver it to Freeview and all of those things. They run the actual broadcasting infrastructure. They'll do that. If you want to...
I bet that would be really expensive.
No, it's not. They do it. They compete commercially. There are other companies that do it as well, but they will, you know. So the point is, you can buy that from them. It's a service that they will sell you if you want to pay what they want. Mm. Same thing. Their studios, you know, Mediatake that Russell hosts is a Māori TV show, but is shot at TVNZ,
right?
On TVNZ facilities,
right?
They have a post production facility. They have a internal production company that makes productions and ads for mainly corporate clients, but could do it for anyone, really. They have, you know, they have a set building, even.
When's the last time you were in, I don't know what it is, I don't know what the news studio is called now. Studio One? What's it called?
Suite 3.
Have you been in there since they have the robot cameras?
Yeah, they've been there. Those cameras have been there for like 10 years.
Okay, well, we might be talking about different versions then, because I was there a long time ago,
yeah.
And there was kind of, you know, it was, all right, this is interesting. And then I was there more recently, and I was like, holy shit, this stuff is amazing.
Yeah, but the point is that if you set up, you know, TV magic, I don't know what you call it now that you've, I don't know what you'd call it, a new public broadcast channel, but you could, TVNZ could run that. And if the government owned them and said, do this at cost, it would be pretty efficient. So you can hire other people to make the programming decisions, and you can hire other people to write content and do all that stuff, but you could run it out of TVNZ. It could be, you know, under the auspices of, you know, operated by TVNZ's management, or it could be operated independently. But there's no need to reinvent any of that stuff.
But there might be a need to, because they haven't done the job.
No, but
I'm so saying, you can say, oh, it's because the charter went away. Oh, it's because they have to return a dividend. Blah blah blah.
Well, it is.
No, but that might just be part of it. If they were motivated to make really high quality, public New Zealand interest stories, and you know they do still make some, like with country calendar stuff. If they were really motivated to do that, they would do it without being asked. They wouldn't just make.
The problem is
500 different police shows.
The problem is they literally their only interest is in making content that rates, because ratings brings advertisers.
But that was also their only interest when they were paid to make TVNZ7. They didn't really bother. There were a couple of good shows, but they just didn't really bother. Even when they were told to do it, they just didn't really bother.
They did a good job of it.
They didn't promote the fucking channel.
That's
a really important part of enterprise.
But those are things you could change in their operating scope. If you say to TVNZ, you don't need to return a profit anymore. Any profit you generate goes into a broadcasting fund that funds Radio New Zealand, that funds a public broadcasting channel. And you say, here are the people to run the public broadcasting channel. They make all the decisions. You provide them all the technical resources that are required at cost. You know, so there's no profit making coming, because that would be pointless to make profit and return the profit to, you know. I think that would be a perfect solution. And then you just put the right people in charge of doing that. It doesn't need to have any. TVNZ can carry on doing exactly what they do now for whatever reason to return profit. Or compete against it, basically.
But the thing is that they would be competing against a channel that they also controlled.
Well, then you make
them not. It wouldn't be fair competition, would it?
I don't know. But the point is, I don't think there's a need to reinvent a lot of this. I think a lot of this already exists and can simply be changed by modifying the terms of operation.
I suspect that's wishful thinking. I think that a public broadcaster is just so dramatically different from how TVNZ operates now. But I just don't know if they can go back to doing that job.
I'm sure they can.
They would bloody leave TVNZ and go to a real public broadcaster, because there are people that work there, have worked there for a long time, because they believed in the place. Now it's just commercial television.
So many of them. And except there's been a few rounds of redundancies, of voluntary redundancies, and frankly, the people who've been there that long would be fools not to have tried to take voluntary redundancy.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Some of them may be fools.
So we've spoken a bit about leaks.
Sorry, one more thing on the broadcasting. Yeah. The other thing I think should be done for public broadcasting policy is I think that all licensed broadcasters in New Zealand, so everyone who's paying a license to the government for spectrum, should have to pay a levy to fund public broadcasting.
Yeah, I agree on that, actually. Yeah, I think that's clearly true.
That's part of where I think money should come from for that.
Yeah. And Sky could pay a hell of a lot of money because, you know, they use a bit.
Yeah, totally.
I really think that TVNZ need to realize that TV3 and Māori, they are not the competition. The competition is Sky. That's the only real competition. And so getting into Igloo, which thankfully they've just this week gotten out of, was nuts. It was absolutely crazy. And so it's a new CEO, Kevin Kenrick. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see what his next move is. It seems like, now, of course, obviously I know people who work there. A lot of people who work at TVNZ.
Do I?
And yeah, obviously you do. You work there for a bloody long time yourself.
I still go there every few weeks.
But there are, I know that there is an internal project at the moment which no one is talking to me about, because I tell people not to tell me secrets.
Don't tell him secrets. He's terrible.
No, I'm really good at keeping secrets, and I think people should keep bloody secrets. If someone starts saying to me, "I shouldn't tell you about this," I say, "Then don't." But I know that there's some bloody project going on at the moment, and I'm really worried that it's going to break on demand.
Oh, right, I see.
Yeah.
Sure. Really. Look, it's interesting that that's an interesting thing, because we haven't talked about Lightbox, because I don't think neither of us used the beta, did we?
Lightbox is the stupidest name. And Lightbox is a thing that still photographers use to look at negatives.
Okay. Ignoring the name, because Netflix is a good name and it's taken, and QuickFlix is a kind of a shitty name, but it's
a ripoff of Netflix.
Yeah. So ignoring the name,
EasyFlix.
All the reports I've heard from people who've used it are that it's a great start.
Yeah.
But, you know, certainly better than anything that's come before.
Yeah.
And trying to tackle that market. Mm. So that's promising. There's still persistent rumours that Netflix is coming to New Zealand. via Australia.
Netflix is already in New Zealand. Go to discourse.co.nz/VPN. It's surprisingly, it's not very expensive if you sign up for it. Expensive if you don't month to month.
Or you could join one of a number of ISPs that are just blatantly letting you.
Yeah, all kind of just introduced global mode.
And, well, Allcon's owned by Call Plus now, so.
Yeah, I haven't used it yet. I have no reason to, because, of course, I already have discourse.co.nz/VPN that surprisingly it does the same job.
It's not very expensive.
It's not very expensive.
That's promising. I think it'll, you know, I still think for me, though, the thing about Netflix, so why I'm still going to continue to pay probably more for Netflix and Hulu and the method I use to get access to them than I am for Lightbox, for example, aside from just the content, is that I watch those things on my TV through a little box that I bought for under $100 that works with them.
Yeah.
Seamlessly, so it's such that my 3-year-old can operate it.
Yeah. So Apple TV isn't under $100, but it's not far off, and it's pretty fantastic with Netflix.
So I'm using, in my case, I'm using a Roku and a WD TV player, I think.
You're using two devices?
I have one on each TV.
Oh, okay.
They operate slightly differently, but they both do the same job.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great. And, you know, I think I said it with QuickFlix when they came out, and, you know, I think QuickFlix got onto the PS4 maybe, or the PS3. And I think maybe it's on some of the smart TVs or something. But frankly, until there's a little box, you can go and buy it, Noel Leeming or Dick Smith or whatever, for $50-$60.
Yeah.
It plugs into our HDMI, has a little remote control, and just lets you browse this content. I think it's still a shit service. Like, it's you know, it can be as good as you want as a service. People don't really want to watch TV on their laptop, and they certainly don't want to plug their laptop into their TV. And what's the other solution? Oh, the one that Netflix is the one that Lightbox is promoting is you get an Apple TV and then you use AirPlay on your iPad to send your video to the TV. Which, I mean, no, just no.
So since I've had the Chromecast and the Apple TV plugged in, I am annoyed when I have to watch stuff on the iPad or on the laptop. I hate it when I can't send stuff to the TV. So it's dumb to have a whole plan, which is that stupid workaround with AirPlaying to an Apple TV. But well, it's great to have those available when you want them.
Yeah, they're great features. But, you know, it's not a good solution.
No, it's a terrible solution. It's not the way to do it, especially when it's so cheap to have those little sticks made. You know, you can pumped out of China for nothing.
But nothing, even more than that, like you could, you know, I could right now go and write a Roku channel. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, I'm sure making the advanced ones like Netflix is more complicated. But, yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff on Roku that is available in New Zealand without any trickery.
Yeah.
So, you know, get a Roku to come here and put your bloody app on it.
Would your DNS trick mess up trying to access New Zealand-based geolocated programming?
Depends on how the DNS trickery is, and like I can watch TV on demand from home.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mess that up.
Yeah, not on your Apple TV or your Roku or anything, is that right?
No, I just have to watch that on the web. But
it's very frustrating because every week I watch ITM Fishing Show with Matt Watson, and every week I have to watch it on my fucking laptop. I want to watch it on the damn TV, and I don't want to be there, you know, when it actually plays.
There was a period of time where the Apple TV, there was when I had my I have XBMC installed on my Apple TV, and there was a period of time where there was a script for XBMC that worked reasonably well with the New Zealand streaming, with the New Zealand on-demand sites, with TVNZ on-demand and TV3, but they've both smartened up their security since then.
Yeah.
So they don't work anymore.
I don't feel like it's actually smart, eh?
Well, they've toughened up.
No, I know what you mean, and they will think that they smartened up, but I just don't think it's actually smart. I think that, so for a while TVNZ's motto or mission statement was on every screen.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily matter, you know, in some respects, it doesn't necessarily matter if your advertising is playing or not. If people are watching your stuff, you know, to some degree, that's true. Like HBO, probably they'd send a few takedowns, I bet. But they also, actually, they quite liked it in some ways when Game of Thrones exploded. Because, you know, every time someone watches, you know, one of those ripped-off shows, there's always a bug in the corner that tells you who the broadcaster was, who the producer was.
Yeah, and there's plenty of people.
It's advertising.
There's lots of other things, lots of other fringe benefits for those people. like, yeah, you know, I'm always, I never really want to justify piracy, but at the same time, it's never as bad as it's painted.
I would never illegally download a program.
I'm sure you wouldn't.
I would never do that. Vast left-wing conspiracy. That's a suggestion. I think we should have one. So we've been talking a lot about leaks. There's been another leak in the last day or so, a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And this is these stolen
celebrity
photos. And Cameron Slater wrote a post on Whale of Will saying leaking hurts and comparing himself to like Jennifer Lawrence.
I swear to God, if Whale don't release his naked photos of Cam Slater...
Right click save. Set as wallpaper.
Yep.
That would be terrible.
Exactly right.
So the difference, of course, is public interest. There is, obviously, there's some interest amongst some people in seeing Jennifer Lawrence naked, but it's not public interest. It's prurient interest.
I'm reasonably pleased to report that I have neither seen nor sought out any of those images. I just don't give a shit.
I do give a shit. I really care.
Well, I mean, I don't give a shit to pursue them.
Yeah, no, that's quite right. I think people shouldn't look.
No, I didn't.
Because it actually is, it is an abuse. This is not like these nudge, nudge, wink, wink, leaked things. You know, there's, you know, a few years ago there were all these sex tapes which accidentally got leaked, and a bunch of, you know, sleazy women making an effort to try and kickstart a career. Right? This is not like that. There is no intent with these ones. It's quite clear that these are private photos. The purpose for these pictures was whatever these women wanted to put them to, and that was not to give them to any of us. And so this is definitely an abuse. And someone said that this was kind of a symptom of rape culture, and I think that's probably accurate, because they don't give consent for. I mean, it's a form of sexual something or other. And these women didn't give consent to be a part of that.
So there's two things that can't. One is Lena Dunham tweeted something that got retweeted many, many times.
Yeah.
And that is, she said that people advising, you know, people saying that, well, you shouldn't have taken naked photos of yourself is like people saying, well, you shouldn't have, you know, worn those clothes.
Yeah, it's absolutely false. Yeah, it's absolutely false.
So, yeah, I disagree with that. And Ricky Gervais, apparently too soon afterward, because he's deleted the tweet now, said, tip to celebrities, if you don't want naked photos of yourselves to appear to be stolen from your computer, don't put naked photos of yourself on your computer. And both are blunt. And I think lack some sense. Because I had a conversation with someone on Twitter today about this. And they said initially something along the lines of I was thinking that I thought I was really crazy for having naked pictures of myself, but or something like that, but you know, in discussing with other people, apparently it's quite normal. And I said that I don't or wouldn't, because, you know, it's just a matter of assessing the risk. Like, I know that there's with anything I have on my computer or any sort of internet storage, there's always a potential that it gets stolen deliberately. You know, either someone targets me and steals something, or more likely that it's just stolen as a, you know, I lose control of it out of my own, you know, by no fault of my own, and just accidentally more than anything else. You know, someone, it's just collateral damage and something. And so there's a thing, you know, if you put those things somewhere, there is the risk that they get stolen. Even if it's just your phone, you know, you leave your phone in a cafe and someone picks it up. So I think that there's a level of risk assessment that needs to happen with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because we get too confident with, you know, with our phones being an extension of ourselves and being our, you know, our private memory bank or whatever. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah.
I think you need to think about what's on there and how much you have the ability to control it.
Yeah. So I have a naked photo of me on my Flickr.
And now it's on my screen. Thank you. Yeah.
That is that's a friends and family picture though, so please don't share it.
Oh no.
I don't actually mind if people see it. I just don't want you to share it. You didn't expect that, did you?
I did not know what I was. Didn't realize that was something I was gonna. I didn't know what I was gonna click on.
Yeah. You shouldn't have such body shame, bro. That's the real reason that you're afraid to put naked photos of yourself even on your own computer, let alone on the internet.
Well, you know what? There is maybe the part of that. I don't have any interest in looking at naked photos of myself.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone else does. So I have no particular desire to take them. But beyond that, even if I did, you know, I'm too confident. I'm too unconfident of my ability. You know, I'm too confident of the fact that they could become out of my control.
Yeah.
So for all the photos that have been hacked from celebrities, there's probably 100 for every one of those. There's probably 100 photos on the internet of people that have been leaked. You know, have been released by jilted ex-partners.
Yeah, and that's horrible and it's shameful.
No, it is. It's terrible, but. Yeah. If you take, you know, digital files is just so ridiculously easy to copy and propagate.
Yeah.
And if you make them, you just need to consider the risks.
Yeah.
And the risks are that you lose control of them one way or another.
That's right. But of course, and while
it doesn't
that,
make it right.
Yeah,
it
while makes it while right. That is true, it is also putting the onus on an innocent victim when the person who did wrong was not the woman who took a photo of her beautiful young body, right? It was the person that then stole that picture. That's the only person who did something wrong.
Not saying, definitely not saying that anyone did anything wrong by taking those photos. Just
to, I know. I just wanted to clarify that.
No, and that's totally right. And anyone who says that is a dipshit. Victim
blaming
of any sort
sucks. But it's that same thing. If you haven't got anything to hide, you haven't got anything to fear. Well, no, fuck you. Everyone has something to hide, not because they are necessarily ashamed, but because it's just private.
Yeah, so
it's just private.
The consideration is just, you know, the digital files are just so porous.
The internet is a copying machine. It's all it does. Just copies stuff.
So just be careful what the hell you put on it, really. That's the main thing. There's so much chance of putting things on it that you don't want to be leaving your control.
I'm really sad for Jennifer Lawrence because, like, she is like every interview that I've ever seen of her, everything that I've ever really seen her do, she is just so sweet. She's just a sweetheart. If she had wanted to do, like, let's say a topless scene, she would have done it. She didn't want to, and so she didn't do it. And it's not right for people to take it out of her hands. I mean, I actually couldn't even name any of the other people involved, but it's just like, I'm sure the others are, you know, varying degrees of similar sweetness. She's only young as well, you know. I understand that the young people these days, Dylan, the young people, the ones that definitely don't get on my lawn, they do the sexting thing and it's just a normal part of how they relate with one another now, and there is meant to be like a new etiquette, and usually people don't get betrayed with them because there is a new etiquette, and I'm sure this is just part of that, you know.
Well, so it was interesting. Australia just in the last week or 2 weeks, or probably longer ago than that, maybe I only heard about it the last week or 2 weeks, but Australia recently made changes in the law that essentially decriminalised the sending and receiving of, well, basically the sending of naked photos by minors of themselves.
Right. So previously they would have been deemed to have been in breach of like child.
Well, essentially, yeah. Previously, they would have been
things.
Trafficking child pornography.
Right, even though it's pictures of themselves.
Yeah, so if some 17-year-old takes a nude selfie of themselves and pics it, or whatever the kids do these days, to their boyfriend or their girlfriend, then that is, you know, that was a crime, technically. And if someone wanted to, you know, it's like a statutory rape, you know, where you get those situations where two underage people have sex and then one of
them. Yeah, like a 14-year-old and a 14-year-old in 7 months.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, even just, whatever, 15, but where, you know, where some person's family decides to pursue that with the police and it's a crime because it's a crime.
Yeah.
So they've removed that.
Right. I took about approximately 400 photos of my son in the bath tonight. Approximately 400 photos.
I have, is that thing, you know, it doesn't happen anymore, of course, because we don't take our films to chemists and stuff to be processed. But there was always those cases, those stories of people being, you know, prosecuted and visited by the Child Protective Services and things like that for taking films in to be developed with photos of their children in the bath.
Yeah.
Shit like that.
That's not the job of so I don't know if do we actually have a thing called Child Protective Services? Ours
is CIFS. It would be CIFS, or it's not even called CIFS anymore. It hasn't been called CIFS for like 10 years. I don't know what it's called now. But
well, whatever it's called, it's that's not the job of CIFS. That's not what they're there for. Yeah. No, I remember what you're talking about. I remember that.
I don't think it happened often in New Zealand, but it certainly had happened around the world.
They've spoken, I'm sure, at least once on Metafilter, like people who actually worked in like Walmart photo developing labs and stuff, and they would talk about how when they came across these roles, not child abuse things, but you know, sexy roles, they would just make two sets of prints. And the, yeah. And I mean, there was pretty broad discussion about how that was, it sounds like that was really standard practice. You know, when it's like a 17, 18 or 19 year old operating the developing machine, you know, as soon as they see, oh, there's a nip. Okay. Well
you know,
I'm printing two copies.
But the same thing you see anonymous, you know, you see anonymous commenters on places like that talking about what they've done and, you know, in consumer facing electronics returns, electronics repair, you know, so like you're the genius or whatever they call them at some computer store.
Yeah.
And some guy brings his laptop in to be fixed. You fix his laptop and then you take a squiz around his hard drive for images.
Yeah. Look for the secret folder on the desktop.
Yeah, totally. And you know, that's another thing about taking nudie photos of yourself. Like my cell phone, the charging port broke a couple of weeks ago, and so I had to take it in to be repaired. And so, of course, I couldn't charge. So when the battery ran out, it was run out. There's nothing I could do to remove content from it or
take out the SD card.
Eh?
Take out the SD card.
Well, some of the content's on the SD card, but other content is internal. And even if I took out the SD card, it's still, you know, the phone still has authorization to my Dropbox and all those things.
Right.
So, you know, there's that thing that I take it in. I trust the service technician, hopefully, that they're just too busy to fuck about looking for shit on my phone. Which I think they probably are.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's that sort of thing as well. You know, there's not a shortage of stuff that's left people's control that way either. You know, it's just anything like that. It's just scary having that sort of stuff, you know, really personal stuff on any device.
Yeah. So what we really need is to have this security and privacy stuff needs to be implicit in our computing experience. It needs to be just a built-in part of it. Not some add-on checkbox that you need to be, you know, smart, experienced computer user to know to even tick, but it just needs to be part of the whole thing. Like,
but even if it is now, right? So even if you can't fuck it up now, but like passwords are annoying.
Yeah.
You know, so people save their passwords or people use simple passwords or whatever. So, like, you know, you could store your things in Mega. Seems pretty secure. I don't know. No one seems to have busted it yet. So you could stick all your stuff in Mega, but chances are you're going to save your password because you don't want to type that password, or you're going to choose a shitty password. And then when someone gets a hold of your phone or your computer or whatever it is, or accesses your email account.
And they find passwords lol.txt on your desktop.
Yeah, exactly. Then you lose that stuff. It doesn't matter how secure the storage is. It's securing the access to it that's the problem. And unfortunately, securing the access to it has to be inconvenient to be effective.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, inconvenient things aren't convenient.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a solution to this. I think really it's just about education. You know, people just need to think about the content they generate, where it goes, how access to it is controlled. You know, what happens if they lose physical control of something that has access to the content, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's complicated. But it's just another, it'll, you know, I'm sure in 10, 15 years from now, it'll become, it's just a skill that people have and there's no thought about it. It's just, you know, people get good at protecting their shit because to some extent you'll have to.
Yeah. So remember a few weeks ago we spoke about things costing more in New Zealand than overseas.
Oh,
and you were like, you should blah, blah, blah. You need to do the bloody research. And I was like, I'm not going to do the bloody research. Well, there's a site I'm not going to read called frontup.co.nz that has done the research.
Good. That's what I wanted to see.
Frontup.co.nz. I don't know if this supports my position.
Well, it seems to, because the big text on the red box at the top says we're tired of paying more for consumer goods than the rest of the world, and we're pretty sure you are too. So I'm going to say that they agree with your position, and I'm hoping that somewhere in here, and I'm not going to do it right now.
Is it going to be a summary?
That there's some pretty good actual detailed information about how that works. However, I've been bitching about this on Twitter just tonight, or rather 2 days ago.
Here's the first example I looked at. magazine prices hurt more than paper cuts. So this is about Vogue. The cover Vogue price right now, in the UK is £3.99, which
is about
$7.91.
Oh, is it that much? Okay.
And so it should be $8, you'd say, in New Zealand approximately. It's $26 in New Zealand.
Now, see, this was the thing I remember from Borders. You could buy, I don't know if this is the case, but you could buy
You could buy early copies, right?
Yeah, like you could buy the ones that
early copies.
Exactly, that came out essentially, you know, within a day or two of the European or US release.
Yeah.
And you know that basically someone had to put a small box of those, because they weren't going to sell very many, they had to put a small box of them on a plane and fly them over. So it's pretty easy to see how that price occurs. But if that's the regular, you know, retail price for the one that's distributed through the primary distributor here, that does kind of suck.
The subscription price for 12 issues is $367 New Zealand.
Which is, is that the $12? I think it was the $23 breakdown of. Yeah, that's quite a lot. So, it doesn't seem like it would cost that much to mail it here from wherever the hell it's published.
So it's possible to use international magazine subscription services, import a single copy for yourself, and it costs about $130 less to do it that way than to use a New Zealand subscription provider.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So that was really my major complaint last time, and that is that it should never be possible for an individual person to pay full, you know, retail and then pay for a single object to be imported and to land it for less than a company should be able to do it, when presumably they're doing it in bulk, you know, maybe have more sophisticated shipping arrangements, are buying wholesale internationally and so on. It shouldn't be possible for New Zealanders to be able to import single retail items for less than retailers can do it.
What I think though is, if you draw it on a bell curve, or you know, if you graph it, like where the, like, you know, bringing in one is expensive, bringing in three is three times as expensive as bringing in one, bringing in five is five times expensive as one, but maybe by the time you get to 20 or 50, then it's dropped way out the other side.
Yeah.
So I think maybe, I still think there's going to be issues here where scale is a problem. Like those magazines, for example, I think, you know, maybe at that price you just don't sell very many, or when Borders was doing it, you just don't sell very many at that price, so you don't bring very many, and because you don't bring very many, you can't get the price breaks on bringing them together.
Yeah.
So I think it's complicated, but the one I was bitching about today was
Lego.
No, Civilization Beyond Earth.
Oh yeah, so you bought it on Steam, right?
Pre-order on Steam.
Yeah.
If you're in America, it costs you $49.95 US dollars on Steam to pre-order it, so you'll be able to download it when it's released.
Yeah.
I mean, you may or may not know the answer, but what do you think the New Zealand price for a New Zealand registered Steam account, or the price for a New Zealand registered Steam account for that same product is? Downloading from the same servers, using the same service, it's the same product.
Wait, sorry, you're going to have to start again. So this is buying from Steam.
From Steam.
In US dollars versus buying from Steam in New Zealand dollars.
No, in US dollars.
Yeah.
New Zealand accounts on Steam buy in US dollars.
Yeah.
But they get different pricing for being in New Zealand.
What? Since when? Is that a thing?
It is for some products, yep.
I don't know what the US dollar price is going to be. I'm going to say it's going to be 115 New Zealand dollars.
That may be true. So it's $49.95 if you're in the US. If you're in New Zealand, it is $89.95. The same currency, US dollars. There's no currency conversion
involved. Those motherfuckers.
It is 80% more expensive.
Those motherfuckers.
80%.
That's not all right.
No.
Who's making that extra money?
Well, Steam says, because this has been brought up in the past, Steam says that the distributors set the prices. Steam doesn't control the prices of the products in their stores.
So they're protecting the arrangements that they have with New Zealand retailers?
That appears to be the case.
Fuck those guys.
So the New Zealand retail price, EB Games sells it in New Zealand for, I think, the same price, $89.95 is the pre-order price from EB Games in New Zealand, or maybe it's even slightly less than that.
That's some bullshit. So hopefully you'll be able to get Civilization. What was it? Uprising? What was it?
Oh, sorry. It's Civilization Beyond Earth. It's $100 at EB Games New Zealand, which is slightly cheaper than $89.95 US.
You shouldn't. Yeah. See, so you shouldn't be able to buy a physical artifact that was imported into New Zealand for less than you can download a file.
It does
that
seem
should
rather absurd.
Not be possible, because then as soon as you install it, it's going to go and download a giant day one update anyway.
Yeah, that's annoying. So
hopefully it'll be on Green Man Gaming, though. That's a way to get better prices sometimes.
Say that. Let me find it. It is on Green Man. Is it Green Man Gaming? Yeah, it is.
It's surprising how many games aren't on there, and some of them are on there very briefly.
Okay, it's on greenmangaming.com. I don't know what that is. I've never heard of it before until I started complaining about this on Twitter and someone pointed it to me. And it, on there, it's $49.99, which is the US
price. So that is the way that New Zealanders get the US price.
Yeah, like, so you're essentially buying a Steam...
You get a Steam key. Yep. Yeah, I've used Green Man Gaming before. It feels sketchy as fuck the first time you do it. So sketchy. But like, so basically what you're doing, you might not be familiar with it, what it's actually like to buy PC games these days, but you know, you open the box, and inside that box there's a DVD, and you can install it off that DVD, but there's also a piece of paper which has a serial code. You could put that DVD in and install it and put your serial code in, or you can just put that serial code directly into Steam and it will download directly from them rather than using the DVD. And what they're basically doing is selling that piece of paper with no disc.
Is that the case? Well, there you go.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much how it works. And I wish that was a way that more New Zealand retailers would do it. Like, there have been times when I just wish Mighty Ape, as well as sending out the game I bought off them, would just take a photo with their goddamn phone of my new serial number so I can start fucking well playing it rather than waiting for the damn disc to arrive.
I think someone was suggesting that EB might be doing that.
Right. I just don't know that I would ever go to EB.
No, I mean, it's not. I don't... Like, I think I've discussed my problem with gaming.
Yeah.
Have I discussed my problem with gaming?
It's a time sink?
No, it's the fact that I keep buying games and I just never fucking install them.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you did mention that. I've been playing a game the last couple of days. I shouldn't have been.
Oh, no, sorry. No, it's a physical product. You buy it and you have to go and pick up the product from EB right. Games. So, fuck that.
I've been playing BioShock Infinite.
I think I own that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Didn't start off good, but it got pretty good. I think I've burnt about 20 hours on it. It's a terrible waste of time. I shouldn't touch it. I shouldn't do it. But, you know, I do it instead of, you know, doing more interesting things. Things that actually make money, for instance. Things that might be have a longer term satisfaction. But there's a lot of fun of, you know, shooting things.
You have a you're a parent now. How can you still play games? I don't understand.
Well, you have three kids and I have one. That I'm sure that makes a difference.
I'm imagining probably at some point in the early part of being a parent, there was a time when I still could have played games. I don't remember it.
Yeah.
It's so long ago.
Yeah. Also, I might have my shit more together than you do.
Well, I'm not promising that you don't.
I don't know if that's true.
We'll see. Still plenty of time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But everyone keeps telling me, oh, it's going to go wrong, though. It's going to go wrong. And it just keeps not going wrong.
I don't think it's going to go wrong.
No, it's like, it's going to get hard. You'll get the thing and everything will fall apart. And then the crying and the sprays of poo. And it's like, okay, but the spray of poo that you talk about, I've seen that. It's just a little bit of poo. It's like, Dylan, if there's poo on the floor, what do you do?
Wipe it up. That's gross.
You wipe it up. That's it. It's in the past. You don't even need to worry about it anymore. If he spews, what do? You change his clothes. Done. It takes, you know, 45 seconds and he's in different clothes. The old one's in a hamper. And it might as well not have happened.
I don't know if I don't know if this is a thing you've experienced yet or not, but there's a thing that happens sometimes where the poo is very liquid.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got that. And he's had that since he had his vaccinations.
Right, and when you lie on your back and you have a nappy on and you have very liquid poo.
Goes up his back.
Gravity, yeah, it's just, those are the worst. It's like, oh, God, do I have
I don't know how far breathing. Up his back. I mean, so he's 2 months old, right? He's little. So he doesn't have a huge volume of poo. So maybe there's something different's going to happen if he's like 9 or 18 months or whatever, right? But he's had that and it's like, okay, well, this can't be what people talk about with the poo explosion, because you change his clothes, you wipe him up, and then it's done.
You know what? It's probably more about when it happens when you're not at home. Those are the worst ones.
Yeah, I've had to change him a couple of times.
Should we do a parenting podcast soon? Should we diversify the discourse parenting podcast?
We
can just talk about poos and wheeze and vomit.
I would still like to do one about weight loss and maybe a little bit about exercise.
Yeah, I've lost interest in losing weight and exercising, though.
I could tell you how to lose weight.
I know a number of successful ways of losing weight. I'm just not doing any of them.
So I was told in a text only days ago, start a mommy blog and you're dead to me. But I don't think that podcasting about parenting, that's not the same as having a mommy blog.
We could get Ben on and we could call it Discourse Daddy Daycare, because we were talking about that today.
Yeah.
There's an article and stuff which I'll send you a link to so you can put it in the show notes as we draw towards the end of this, I'm sure, because it's very long now. Yeah. Today about people's attitudes towards fathers sometimes.
Oh yeah, like what?
It's essentially the idea that things people say to mothers when they see the fathers doing things with children, like dad's looking after the kids so you can get out for a little bit, is he? Oh, that's you're so lucky. That's very what a good father. It's like, it's just parenting. That's just doing. The one that always got me was there are people who I heard it in the wild not long ago, maybe a week or two ago, which is where someone says that the father is babysitting.
What?
Yeah, it totally happens. I'm sure you'll hear it at some point. Someone will say, Jeff. I'm using the word name Jeff. It doesn't mean anything. Oh, Jeff's babysitting the kids so I can pop out for a while this afternoon.
Fuck you.
Exactly.
Don't marginalize me.
No, and it's not like if that's
I'm not on the fringe. This is a fucking team. We work together.
Totes, bro. Totes as. So anyway.
I don't know how you could do this without feeling like you were a team.
I think there are people who do. I think
it would be so much harder.
It's those things that if you don't know, you're missing them necessarily. Because I certainly know from interactions with other parents and from interactions my wife has had with other mothers that there are certainly people out there who, fathers out there especially, who are not as involved with the children as you or I might be. And I, you feel like, oh, that's a terrible word, but I suppose it's just, it's the dynamic that they've developed and it's not necessarily right or wrong.
It's wrong.
Or good or bad.
It's bad.
But it just is. But yeah, it's weird. I mean, there's certainly a generational thing to some extent, like people that are, a lot of the older generations were not as used to parents or fathers spending, being as involved with their children.
Yeah.
But there's no reason for that to be.
No. I love that little boy so much.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if that continues to grow or not, or if it's a static thing, you just change your view of it, but it certainly seems to grow. Because there's how old is Fox? He's like
2 months.
6 weeks, 8 weeks. Yeah. So as awesome as that is, as awesome as he is at this stage and as much as you love him now, it just becomes a whole different thing once he starts to really develop an individual personality. Like, it's just so
I think
like,
he has a personality. I know exactly what – I believe that I know what you mean. Like, once he can actually talk. Last night, though, so the limit of our communication until last night was if I smiled at him and he actually was paying attention to me, which is – it's very limited that he really pays attention. He's very interested in looking at light things, not just looking at people. He's not totally attached to faces yet, right?
Yeah, they're a bit boring, to be honest.
So if there's interesting light play going on, like around the ceiling and stuff, he'll be looking at that. but sometimes when he looks at me, like if I smile, he'll smile. Right? He is clearly seeing, interpreting, understanding, and reflecting it and sending it back. Right? So it is definitely communication. And this is not my original thought. It is said that that is really the first form of communication that kids have with those smiles. First form of social contact, really. But last night, he made a little, a little groaning noise. He'd just been fed and he sort of went, eh. And I mimicked him and he smiled. And so I did it again. I went, eh. And then he went, eh. He copied the noise back to me that I was copying off him. And then he gave a big smile. And we must have gone back and forth. Like he had pause and I'd go eh and then smile at him and he'd go eh and smile back at me, and it was totally, we were like interacting with a weird little a conversation with no real words, it was really cool. It was so much fun. I just don't understand why anyone, any parent, wouldn't want to be right in the middle of that. Why wouldn't you do that?
Totally. And
babysitting, what? This hurts me, man.
Yeah, people are funny.
But it's so sad that people would think that way.
But daddy daycare is a different thing. There's a distinct thing that happens with daddy daycare, which is, you know, as much as I'm involved with my children, when I am left alone with them to look after them for a whole day or more, the dynamic in the household changes substantially.
Yeah.
Not for the better or the worse, but let's just say there's more mess and food is different.
Is there more juice?
Sometimes.
I was really bothered the other day when people were.
Oh, fucking hell.
And yes. And some of them like even
For what you know, for your knowledge, that bottle of juice that I tweeted about the other day is still in the fridge and since then has gone down by about another 100 milliliters.
Right.
Like that's the level of consumption we're talking about.
We've spoken before about this and I suggested that your kids might like some juice and you were like, no, they can have water.
They almost
of all the people that need to be told not to give their kids juice, you're none of them. You don't need that message. And then when I was like, can you motherfuckers not tell Dylan what to do with his own kids? They were like, but public health. And it's like, no, you're not talking about public health. You're talking about Dylan's kids. This is not, you're actually talking directly to a person about what he gives his own children. You're not talking to a population.
Without any knowledge. Context for this is I tweeted a photo. There's a juice that Just Juice makes.
With broccoli in it.
It has broccoli and carrot in it. So it's like orange and pineapple and broccoli and carrot, I think. And to be fair, the broccoli is like 2% broccoli, barely any broccoli, but
yeah.
It's got broccoli in it. And it's on the label, it says broccoli. And I think the tweet was a photo of the bottle. And I said, it's crazy. Even the children who could read still drink this juice, basically knowing that it's got broccoli in it.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, two people, I think, maybe even three, replied to say to the effect something like that's not good stuff, it's still just crap.
Of course it's crap.
Well, you know what, it's not
everyone. Well, but it is. I mean, everyone knows it is. It's got bloody sugar in it, it's garbage.
It has no added sugar, so it absolutely.
Oh yeah,
no, but it's
they have ways of getting around that.
No, it doesn't need. It's juice. Like, juice tastes good. Juice is high in sugar. There's no question about it that juice is a lot of sugar. It's the same sugar you get from eating a fruit. It's fructose.
Oh, but maybe it is.
But none of that is important. Like, it's still, it's juice. Like, we're not, you know, like I see kids, I roll my eyes when I see kids drinking fizzy drinks. Like,
yeah,
my 9-year-old has only had fizzy drinks in the last maybe 2 years. My 5-year-old doesn't even like any fizzy drinks. The 3-year-old certainly hasn't had any.
Yeah.
You know, and when he has fizzy drinks, which is so rare, his grandparents give them to him because that's, you know, grandparent thing, whatever. He gets, like, on the drive up to my grandparents' house, he usually gets a small bottle of, I think, L&P is the one he likes.
Right.
But, you know, like, that's rare. My children will ask as a treat for a cup of milk.
Right.
Like, that's a treat drink for them. Not that we don't give them milk, but they usually just have it with their cereal and stuff. Like, they're not drinking a lot of milk.
Right.
Because that's, you know, and juice is so rare.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you know, people are weird.
People are very weird.
But it's that thing is, that, you know, there's this other thing. At schools, I don't think at schools anymore they don't really teach good food and bad food.
Do they not do the pyramid?
No, I don't think so. Like, what they do is, you know, foods you should eat often and treat foods.
Right.
Because it's a much more useful way of looking at things.
Oh, it's a very simplified way. I don't know if
it's but I mean, it's, if you just call things bad foods, then, you know, that doesn't give you any concept of, you know, it's not like there's good food and bad food. You can have, yeah, anyway, but it's, I think, food
education. But the whole point of the pyramid was the stuff down at the bottom is stuff that you should have a lot of, and the stuff at the top is stuff you should have very little of. I mean, it was the same
stuff at the stuff at the bottom is, yeah, I mean, the pyramid, the history of the food pyramid is fucking terrible in itself. It was designed by the corn board, I think, to sell more corn, basically. Yeah. In the US, some corn industry thing, but you know, it's, people have some very binary views on food that I think are not helpful. Food is not a binary thing. You just need to understand, you know, you need to think about food.
Yeah, take it from the fat guy.
Yeah, totally. But I know
the fat guy about food.
But let's be fair. I know why I'm fat.
Yes,
I'm not in any. I'm under no illusions about any of the reason. I know precisely ways that I could address it. I'm choosing not to, which is dumb, but, you know, whatever.
I know why I'm fat too.
Yeah. So, and my children aren't fat. not even remotely, despite the fact that, you know, they eat probably crappy food more often than they should, but at the same time, they don't eat very much of it.
It'll come. Actually, given that, so the elder one, given that he hasn't, I mean, he's thin. He's like a rake.
Yeah.
It's much less likely that he's ever going to get fat, given that.
No, I mean, that's interesting.
Like, there are danger signs pretty early on, and none of your kids give any of them.
No, I think it's portion control the thing as well. You know, they just don't, you know, even when they eat, you know, even when we give them McDonald's or whatever.
What control?
They're not eat portion control. You remember, you
I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't keep eating until you puke. That's the
why not? The trick of it. But I don't know. But you get to enjoy it twice or even sometimes three times if the bits are nice and big.
I don't understand it. I totally don't.
Oh, we better end this fucking show. This has gone on really long.
It's probably should have ended a long time ago.
I'm Morgan Avery.
I'm Dylan. Just Dylan.
Fish and chips. Sorry, and chips. The show is cancelled. Beep.